Welcome to the supporting cast. This is Eli Goldsmith. On April 25th, the NFL Network's Rich Eisen will host his 21st NFL Draft, anchoring what will amount to a roughly 20-hour broadcast held over multiple days, framing compelling narratives and moderating impassioned debates about the NFL's next generation of stars. In this episode, Rich tells his story, from growing up in Staten Island as the child of two educators, to the University of Michigan and the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern, to being hired by ESPN in the mid-90s to host SportsCenter at the tender age of 26. Rich and I speak about the value of education, the craft of writing, and yes, we talk this year's NFL draft, the quarterbacks, the potential trades, and what my Chargers, yes, I am a helpless LA Chargers fan, may do at pick number 5. The great Rich Eisen on a life in sports broadcasting. This is the supporting cast. Rich Eisen, welcome to the supporting
cast. Thank you, sir. What an honor to be part of the Harvard-Westlake community, and that's just because this is the Wolverines, which is my collegiate mascot.
Michigan,
yes,
that's right.
Yes, indeed. So it was kind of a kismet to see Harvard-Westlake Wolverines and my boy Coop wanting to come here. Worked out perfectly.
The Michigan Wolverines, who are national champions.
That is, you could say that again.
Who are national champions.
Yes, indeed. I'm happy to say that over and over again. The sun shines brighter, food tastes better. It's great. It's awesome.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I had nothing to do with it, but I'll take it.
Were you there?
Cooper and I, along with the rest of our family, went to the Rose Bowl. So we were at the Rose Bowl, them playing for the right to play in the national championship game here at the Rose Bowl, where I covered the 1990 Rose Bowl for the student publication of Michigan Daily, which is what I wrote for the student newspaper when I was there. And I covered Bo Schembechler's final season, and his final game was here at the Rose Bowl. So for me to have the opportunity to take Susie, my wife, and my three kids, Cooper is the current Harvard-Westlake student, take all of them and my nephew Jack to the Rose Bowl to see Michigan play for the right to play for the national championship game, take on Alabama, was a great moment for me personally. Thinking of at the time, 20 years old. I was 20-year-old as a senior in college. Now as a 54-year-old guy with three kids and a wife, and to take them to the Rose Bowl to see that game was really emotional. It was very special for me. Made even more so by the fact that they won it all. And last year's national championship game, which they were one step away from making, was here in Los Angeles. It was in SoFi. So Cooper and I had our dreams dashed of just needing to go down the 405 to see Michigan play in the national championship game. So we did not go to Houston, where they won the whole enchilada against Washington, but we're at the Rose Bowl, which is awesome.
That's amazing. Well, we start off every conversation, Rich, with
sort
of grounding ourselves in the present. And so first, I just want to ask, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
How's your family?
We're great.
And thank you for being here in person on campus.
Well, I prefer doing conversations in person.
Yeah, me too.
I think they're better than Zooms, so it's a pleasure to do this, and I appreciate you doing it at this time so I can then scoop Coop up at the end of his day. That's how we're recording this. And my wife and I, we love being part of the Harvard-Westlake community. We've had a blast so far, and Coop loves it. I mean, he just came back from the trip to Washington, D.C., Mr. Gaskin and the rest of the crew. He loved it. You know, he loved it. He's sending us pictures of the Liberty Bell and in Independence Hall and then of Mount Vernon when they got down to D.C. And he's soaking it all in. And I just do love the different parts of this community, that from athletics to everything else that he's availing himself of academically. And you and I, as we were strolling to the studio here, just walking across campus on a beautiful Southern California day. So lucky that he gets to walk on a spot like this. And every day, I'm assuming, we really haven't had that deep of a conversation about it, but I'm assuming that he's picking up on the possibilities and the excitement of walking into a campus like this every day and seeing everything laid out in front and knowing how, you know, your mind can be expanded and your heart could be grown and things of that nature. I know I feel it. And I was telling you, I felt like it was like walking to the campus at the University of Michigan, a large community, a large campus in which one might get overwhelmed by the size of it. But Coop had the same feeling I did when I walked on the Michigan campus. It's just that you have a feeling of possibilities and opportunity every single day. And it's pretty cool. My wife and I are loving it here.
That's great. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
The other thing you're staring at, I think, in your professional life, because I'd love to talk some football
anytime
with you. A thrill to talk football.
It's your show, Eli.
Rich Eisen. The NFL draft is coming up.
Yes, sir.
What in your mind, as you guys are thinking, obviously, the NFL Network, and you have a radio show. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about storylines all year round, not just during the season. Kind of what are the biggest storylines that you are picking up on now entering the NFL draft, which is just a few days away?
You are spot on that my role for hosting an NFL draft, and this is going to be, I think, my 21st that I'll be hosting for NFL Network. 20th or 19th in person. We didn't go to our first two drafts in person. 2006 was the first one I hosted in person at Radio City. And then the COVID year was not anywhere.
Yeah.
Everyone was zooming in for that. And my job is storylines. That is it. Because I have the other draft experts who grind the game film and the tape and have a sense of who the players are as humans and also who they are as players and what roles they can fill and how, in other words, they are the experts on the evaluation as to whether this individual can be a good professional player. My job is the storylines, how do fans view it, what teams, what do they need, what have they needed, what have they been missing, and how does this draft choice fit into all of that? And that's what I feel my role is, along with trying to be entertaining, because it is the longest broadcast I do. In terms of sitting there for the day, I guess outside of the combine, it's about, what would you say, 5-6 hours first night, 6 hours the next, and then like 8 hours the day after that. It's a long time. I want you to stay. I want you to not be overwhelmed or turn the set off because you're sick and tired of the sound of my voice or everyone else's voices. So I try to be as entertaining, informative as possible, and the storylines are the way that I'm looking at it. That said, nothing's better for an NFL draft than one that has famous players involved in it at the most visible position, obviously quarterback. Mm-hmm. It's possible we may have quarterbacks as the first four draft choices, which is nuts. And clearly one that is as popular as Caleb Williams leading the way for a franchise that's been looking for a quarterback forever and a day and just traded away their quarterback who they drafted just 3 years ago to clear the decks, to trade away Justin Fields for Caleb Williams. That is the storyline of the draft. And then how many quarterbacks go in a row after him? And then after that, you've got some terrific wide receivers, including Marvin Harrison Jr., who with a very famous father.
Senior,
yeah, Hall of Famer. Where does he wind up? And then you also have some really popular franchises sitting at the top being quarterback needy in the Bears and the Washington Commanders and the Patriots, who, as you know, went 2 decades without being quarterback needy.
No.
So
because of another Michigan Wolverine.
Thank you for bringing that up, Eli. I was going to do it, but I didn't want to be that gratuitous, so I appreciate you saving me that embarrassment. And then you've got the Arizona Cardinals, who are not quarterback needy, sitting in the fourth spot, which is a perfect position to perhaps trade out and get another quarterback needy team in there to get potentially J.J. McCarthy, the Michigan Wolverine national champion quarterback.
Another Michigan Wolverine.
That is correct, sir. And a national champion at that, I must point out. So it's all set up. And then to have Jim Harbaugh, now here in Los Angeles, fresh off of, you can fill the rest of the sentence, he might, which is crazy, have the opportunity to draft Marvin Harrison Jr., an Ohio State Buckeye, just strange bedfellows the NFL can make, to kick off a run at wide receiver. Malik Nabers, who is the tremendously talented LSU wide receiver who caught most of the passes for the quarterback who could be the second draft choice overall, and Jaden Daniels, who won the Heisman Trophy this year after Caleb Williams won it last year. I'm giving you just a general sense of how talented the top of this draft appears to be, which makes it a hugely entertaining watch for the first hour and a half, 2 hours of the draft, where it's just so many passionate fan bases are interested. Recognizable names are being drafted. Coaches who are new to the game and also old and new to the game and Jim Harbaugh are involved. You have a New York franchise in the Jets at 10 with Aaron Rodgers coming back. You've got the Bears choosing again at 9 and potentially getting Roma Dunze, the Washington talented wide receiver, to pair with Caleb Williams. It really is awesome. And I'm genuinely fired up to go to Detroit, which has never hosted a draft before, to go there. It's going to be awesome. Yep.
I suppose what's so great about live sports right now and why so many viewers continue to watch live sports is the unexpected that could occur.
Yes.
And so in a draft, you've got, as you mentioned, the first three teams who are likely to pick quarterbacks, right? The Bears, the Commanders, and the Patriots. But at 4, we don't really know yet. And so what often happens, what makes the NFL draft so exciting, is the unexpected.
Yes.
And so a team wants to suddenly jump up, maybe it's the Vikings or the Broncos, to number 4.
Yes.
To trade with the Cardinals, to get a quarterback. How do you prepare for the unpreparable?
There's no way to do that. But, I mean, you and I are, like, this is prep right now for me. I mean, you and I are recording this, let me get the date right, 15 days before this moment that you and I are predicting, and I think you're spot on, that is going to happen. Everything that I do is prep, where I'm talking about it every day on my daily TV and radio show or podcasts like this or with Coop, you know, as we're getting ready for bed. Everything is content thought process for me. The way I handle it is just to be normal. If something shocking happens, react that way.
Yeah.
You know, if something surprising happens, react that way. Just try and put the fan or the viewer or the listener into your shoes and react accordingly. The way I make sure of that, because you are right, that the unexpected is part of the excitement.
Yeah.
And with the advent of Twitter, or now X, Facebook, and other manners of content delivery, being able to be more immediate than the actual announcement at the draft and place it in the palm of your hands, the information that is yet to be disseminated through the conventional method of delivery of commissioner stepping to podium on live television. Because when the pick gets made, just to give you a quick, pull back the layers. Well, first of all, the NFL draft is the only, and I will bring this all home. the NFL draft is the only event on the NFL calendar where the newsmakers are not physically there. The newsmakers are the decision makers in the draft rooms at their respective facilities, all 32 teams. Those are the newsmakers making the decision as to who to choose. They make that choice. They call it into the NFL with a representative sitting at a phone bank in the draft hall. They take that information. They process it at a processing table. They then call to the back stage where the cards are placed. They're all on a table right next to the commissioner's green room. And what it is they have the names of all the potential draftees printed out so the commissioner can read the handwriting. And the card is basically with the blank pick in the NFL draft, the blank selects, and then the name is already printed out on a card. And all they have to do is just write in physically the name of the team and the name of the draft, the number of the draft choice, and the commissioner reads the card off. So in that entire process of making the call, they've already called the draftee to say, are you ready to join our team? And the reason for that is, you've seen this all the time about a draftee is sitting in the green room crying, or at his home on a couch at a party crying, talking to the team. The teams always call the prospect first, legitimately, to make sure the prospect is alive before they draft him, that they didn't, like, fall down, break a leg, walking up the stairs. Honestly, I swear to you, like they do that purposefully. But in that process, something can leak where an agent knows the player's just been taken or the parent knows the player's been taken. They text somebody, and boom, that information is now on social media before the commissioner announces it. So I purposefully stay off of my phone, which is a Herculean task for me, you know, because I don't have Dr. Carroll threatening to take it away from me. So I stay off the phone so I can have an organic, natural reaction to the unexpected. And I do not have my producers in the truck get in my ear to say, big thing's coming. Because once the pick is written down on the card and handed to the commissioner, the phone banks that takes the information in from the draft rooms, they call the NFL Network truck and the ESPN truck so they can have the graphics ready when the pick is announced that it's on the screen for you as a viewer and all the bells and whistles are there. So the ESPN truck and the NFL Network truck is alerted before the commissioner makes the announcement as to what's about to happen. And they purposefully do not get in my ear or any of the other ears of anybody on the set, because we do have earpieces in our ears.
To retain the suspense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because, and now I do get accused when I do go back on my phones eventually, I do get accused of acting because they assume I already know this stuff. Because if you're sitting at home knowing it, or some of us will guess, like, I think they go wide receiver here. And they think we're saying that fully knowing they're going to go wide receiver so I can look smart, which is absurd.
Yeah. Because the surprise is part of what's
it is. And plus, I also, you know, Eli, have other things to do with my life than to worry about looking smart. I don't mind looking, being wrong. I don't mind that. I'm legitimately reacting and acting the way, you know, my mind and heart and gut tells me to react. And I think that that's what makes for a good broadcast. And I will always be in the dark in the first round of an NFL draft, because I'm assuming you are too. And there are just methods and manners of communication and information dissemination that are, in the last several years, are faster than the actual delivery of the information of a traditional NFL draft broadcast.
Right.
So that's my long-winded way of responded to what you just, you know, asked right
yeah.
there.
One other question before we get to you and your background and history about football. You mentioned Jim Harbaugh just coming off a national championship at the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Now he's come to Los Angeles to coach the Chargers. Full disclosure, I am a very lonely Charger fan.
Well, you're about to be very happy.
And why? What can LA expect? What can Charger fans expect with Jim Harbaugh coaching a franchise that has been kicked around a little over
Understood.
The last couple decades?
I just think it's a level of preparation and a sense, a football sensibility that is winning.
Hmm.
You know, I know that there were times when things weren't going well and looking good for Michigan, but Jim stayed always throughout true to his mantra of hitting the line of scrimmage and hitting it hard, winning that battle and becoming dominant on either side of the line of scrimmage in the line play, in the trenches. And everything comes off of that with a quarterback that he can become the spirit animal to and for, because he is Captain Comeback of the Indianapolis Colts days. His name is in the Ring of Honor there. He's a guy that got chewed out by Mike Ditka, so he knows, and Bo Schembechler, and his dad is a coach too, so he knows about hard coaching and delivering it and not.
His brother is a coach too.
Indeed. And that's part of the reason why he's back, I think, is his brother beat him in the Super Bowl.
That's right.
And he wants to bring another trophy to the table for Thanksgiving dinner of his own. And
do you really think that's right?
I do.
Yeah.
I really do.
Because you probably know, or have,
I don't know. I'm just assuming it, and I'm hearing it, and I believe it, that he wants to win a Lombardi trophy. And the fact that he departed having accomplished the mission at Michigan is another reason why. And it was a perfect opportunity. He moves to Southern California. One thing you also need to have at the professional level is a stud quarterback.
Yep.
And so he knows that. And then an ownership team that I think is fully committed. You've seen the amount of money they're paying Jim, the amount of money they put on the table for the assistants that I, as a Michigan fan, lament having left to join him. Mm-hmm. They're all terrific. And I know there are Charger fans at the moment of this taping that are wondering who's going to catch the football from Justin Herbert. That'll get figured out. I fully believe it, that Jim knows exactly what he's doing, and in him you should trust. And I think just the level of preparation, the level of intensity, the level of play and style of play that is being brought should, now I can't guarantee this, and you'll understand why as a diehard Charger fan, it should remove the mind-boggling and mind-bending Chargers moments that seem to always happen to this franchise. And by that, I mean the fourth down decisions that are weird and never go your way. And if they do, there's some weird fumble that wipes the play out. Or there's some decision like, say, Brandon Staley made when all he needed was a tie to make the playoffs and he tried to win and then lost and didn't make the playoffs. Or a 27-point lead that evaporates, or name it. And it just always seems to happen. It's, you know, the phrase of it is chargering.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I do believe the chargering moments should dissipate, if not completely disappear. I'm obviously biased too. There's a body of water in front of SoFi Stadium, a man-made lake that I believe Jim Harbaugh walked across to take the job.
Wow.
So
you're a true believer.
I am. And I think you're going to really be happier. Yeah. I do.
And back,
the problem is, though, is one thing that Jim can't do is make Patrick Mahomes disappear. That's a problem.
Same division.
So, but the way to do it is, you know, when you have salary cap concerns, you keep Khalil Mack and Joey Bosa, and you do change your wide receiver room. And I think that's part of the decision making that they made is, again, you hit the line, you dominate the line, you figure out the skill position players another day, and I think they will.
And this goes back to the draft, because you had mentioned that it's possible the first four picks will go quarterback.
Yes.
The Chargers own the fifth pick.
Correct.
Which means they could have access to one of the top wide receivers, including this Marvin Harrison Jr., who some people think is the best overall player.
Yes.
In the draft. Or they could trade back, or they could pick someone at the line if Harbaugh is that committed.
No doubt. At the combine, late February, early March, the conversation was the Chargers wanted to trade out of that fifth overall pick in the worst way. And I think part of the reason for that is they thought like Marvin Harrison Jr. would be gone. And the best choice at offensive line is a lineman named Joe Alt from Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. But he's a left tackle, which is something the Chargers don't need, because Rashawn Slater is going to be an all-pro at that spot for a while. They need a right tackle, which Joe Alt is not. So put it all together, and Brock Bowers being a terrific tight end, it's too early to take him. You could trade back and get him. That was the sense leaving the combine. But now that four quarterbacks could legitimately go in a row to start leaving the Chargers with essentially the first overall pick in the draft for non-quarterbacks, which is a position, as we all know, that is not a need for them. I think they would love that for that to happen. And there are some who believe Jim's hyping up of J.J. McCarthy, while completely understandable, because that does reflect well on him, and he does love the kid, my God, why not, that he wants him to be chosen as high as possible. But that also has the residual effect of giving Jim the best possible draft choice if all four quarterbacks go in a row. And I'll just leave it there.
Smart guy.
That's Jim, man. That is him. So that's why I'm like, I think you'll be happy in the long run.
So now I want to get to you.
Sure.
Rich, you grew up in New York. Is that right?
Staten Island, New York. Yeah. Grew up in Staten Island, the fifth and forgotten borough of New York City.
My mom grew up in Staten Island.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, she did. Jersey City, Staten Island.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, Jersey City is not Staten Island.
True, but I think both. She was sort of...
Okay, it's practically the same anyway. Staten Island almost seceded to the state of New Jersey.
Right.
So a lot of people... There are three bridges that attach Staten Island to New Jersey. So we're considered a suburb of New Jersey too.
And big family? You have siblings?
No, my parents are both New York City public school educators.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, which is why, another reason why I love seeing this place.
Yeah.
I grew up under the roof of two educators. And my older brother, Jeffrey Eisen, has been living here for quite a long time. He is a partner of a law firm, Mitchell Silverberg and Knupp, here in town. And if anybody out there needs any help with trust and estates, he is legitimately the GOAT. In that regard, he is a terrific lawyer and one of the best in the United States at this. So I grew up in that household. I'm the younger brother, just the two of us as kids and my parents.
And what do you think was the influence of having two teachers, educators as parents, looking back?
Oh, gosh. Hard work, dedication to hard work. I saw them work their tails off. And then just the respect for others that always comes when you're an educator. That has to be part of your DNA, is respect for others and respect for your mind expansion. And as I mentioned, hard work and dedication. You know, we were, you know, a union household. My dad passed in 2019. My mom currently lives in the Belmont Senior Village in the Wilshire Corridor. A lot of the reason why she's able to reside in that awesome spot is because of her pension and the union, the teachers union, and how strong it was. And so I've grown up for a respect for union shops because of that. And just a childhood memory of mine was to help my mom set up her classroom. She taught mostly kindergarten, but sometimes first and second grade. The night before the school year began, she would set up her room and I would help her out. I do have childhood memories of sitting in the back of the room while they conducted both of them, because my dad was a French teacher and then an administrator later in his career, an assistant principal at Port Richmond High School in Staten Island, New York. I remember sitting in the back of the room sometimes while they conducted parent-teacher, and I would just have to sit back reading a book, which is quite a concept for kids these days, just to occupy yourself.
Did you go to public school then?
I did. Yeah. I'm public school educated all the way up to the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. Mm. So PS 54, IS 72, Susan E. Wagner High School, University of Michigan, which is a public institution of higher learning, and then Northwestern.
Your interest in sports was, mm-hmm. as a kid, yes. Were your parents into sports, your older brother? How were you introduced to?
My older brother was. Yeah. My dad and mom stopped following sports when the Dodgers left Brooklyn. My dad was more of a show tunes guy.
Yeah.
So if not for my brother, I'd probably be doing a show. You know, my daily show would be about Broadway musicals, which I don't know would be as successful as talking sports. But my brother was into sports, and I followed that from him. And then I realized real early in my life that I couldn't hit the curve or make the jump shot. So if I wanted to be in the sports world, I pretty much have to talk about it. I learned that early on.
And you guys were Jets fans?
Well, back in anybody from New York who's listening to this of a certain age knows that your rooting interest in New York City was dependent geographically within the city, but also who played in certain facilities. So you would have Met Jet fans because they both played in Shea, Yankee Giant fans because they both played in Yankee Stadium. Mm. And then when the Jets and the Giants moved to New Jersey, that kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. But if you lived on Long Island, you're most likely a Jet, Met, Net Islander fan. If you lived in New York City, you're most likely Knicks and Rangers. So I was a Jet, Knicks, Rangers, Yankees fan.
Hmm.
And the reason why I was a Yankees fan is one of the other things I learned early on when Catfish Hunter came to the Yankees in 76 from the A's and Reggie Jackson came to the Yankees in 77 from the A's, that I would probably have a better chance of winning more World Series than being a Met fan. So I saw that early on and I hopped off the Met bandwagon. So I'm that rare Yankees, Jets, Knicks, Ranger fan from the 70s. And I'm a Yankee fan to this day. Fortunately for what I do for a living, I love doing what I do for a living. And there, that Rose Bowl story I was telling you about the top of the pod here, I learned early on that was one of the first times I was in a press box. And the Michigan Stadium press box and the Rose Bowl press box of my senior year that I basically lived in, mm-hmm. there was a no cheering the press box rule. It was very strict. And if you cheered there at all outwardly or anything, you were ejected. So I've kind of learned that no cheering in the press box sort of thing. But for Michigan athletics and Yankee baseball, I still have an emotional tie. Like my, you know, not so much with the Yankee baseball, but with Michigan football, like my emotions are affected. Like I have to sit around and Susie, my wife, will like look at me and wonder what's wrong with me that my emotions are so greatly affected. But I mean, I sometimes will even sit there like wondering why, as a 54-year-old father of three, do I go there and have my emotions affected so significantly? But
yeah.
Yankees mean a lot to me, too. Yeah.
I think that's true of a lot of sports fans, actually.
I know that.
Yeah.
I know, but I I do sometimes just lose myself in it. So.
Yeah. When you think about your own educational journey,
yeah.
public high school, elementary school,
yeah.
at the University of Michigan, even at Medill, at the getting your master's in journalism at Northwestern.
Yes.
Can you think of any educators, teachers, or professors that were particularly influential to you as a writer, as
yes.
a thinker?
Yes, outside of my parents.
Right.
There was one, I don't remember his name. I did a summer at Cornell Summer College at Cornell University. And there was a class of writing about Shakespeare. I wish I remembered this professor's name, but he was so full of life and he was so full of vigor and he's so enthusiastic about the craft of writing. Mm. A light finally went on in my head about how to write and that there is a craft to it that you can get into as much as you get into anything else. That there's a love of putting syntax together and nouns and verbs and adjectives, and finding the right adjective and not having the passive verb be used in his sentence and an active verb makes it more punched up, and how that can change somebody's way of reading something and enjoyment of reading something. Like, it clicked. It just went on in my head. I should unearth, if I can, a syllabus or what have you, because I would love to thank that individual.
This was a summer program in high school?
High school. Oh, okay. Junior year of high school. Wow. Going from junior to senior year of high school, I went to Cornell Summer Camp, lived in a U-Haul, which is the name of the dorm room name there on the campus in Cornell. I just remember a light going on and writing, which has been so important for me too. Like, when I got my first major opportunity in my career, it was when I sent a tape from my I was a local news anchor in Reading, which is about 12 hours north of here. Mm-hmm. And I sent a tape to a headhunter. And I got a few weeks later a phone call from the headhunter to say, good job. You've got a really interesting shop that's interested in you. But they're a writing intensive shop. It's about your writing, which you wouldn't think about for sportscasting, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't sit there and think that your written word would be a differentiator. But they focus on your writing, so send us your best writing. It's a writing-intensive shop. So I remade a tape and sent it to them, and the shop turned out to be ESPN, and the show was SportsCenter.
Wow.
At age 26, like I won the lottery. And part of the reason why is because of the written word, because of when you're on camera and you're leading into a highlight and you're turning a phrase and you're writing – and it's got to be concise, and it's got to be interesting, it's got to be funny, it's got to be punched. I was ready for the moment because of that, and I got a job in part because of my writing. And I learned that in Cornell at that summer college about the written word and the crafting of a sentence and the economy of words, the economical way you can write it, avoiding a passive and being more active. You know, I learned it there. And another teacher, whose name I definitely recall, was the professor who ran the Medill School of Journalism, Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism, news division in Washington, D.C. Now, the Medill School of Journalism graduate school, which is what I joined after I graduated Michigan, I wrote for my hometown newspaper, the Staten Island Advance, or as they say on Staten Island, the Advance. I wrote for them for 3 years, and I just knew I wasn't cut out for writing news, which is what I was doing for them. And I wanted to be a sportscaster. I wanted to be on SportsCenter. I wanted to chase that dream. And a couple of my friends who I knew from Michigan, who I worked with on the student newspaper, went to the Medill School of Journalism program, and I knew it was 1 year long. It wouldn't be a large time commitment. And I would go there and you come out of it with a tape. You come out of it with an actual videotape that you could then send to news directors at local stations around the country and look for a job and get started that way. That's the way things were kind of done in the 90s, which is when I was starting. So I went to the Medill School of Journalism. It was only a 9-month program. I didn't have to do the first 3 months because it was an introduction to journalism. And they granted me those 3 months off because my 3 years of being an actual journalist yeah. sufficed. So I showed up for quarter two, which was in Chicago. Quarter two was just basically covering local news events and writing about it. So there I geared things towards sports. I got lucky in the fact that the thing that I covered was Michael Jordan's shocking retirement.
Wow.
That's when I was there. And then quarter three was covering Chicago with a television camera. Now you're done writing, just doing the written word specifically for print. Now we move from print to television. And I did that for 3 months. And the last 3 months was a quarter in Washington, D.C., where they had something called the Medill News Service, where a bunch of TV stations around the country, local TV stations that did not have the budget to have a reporter in Washington, D.C. covering Capitol Hill and things that are happening on Capitol Hill that affect the local market, specifically at the national level, they didn't have the funds for it. So they would use us, the students, as actual news reporters. There were TV affiliates that I worked for in Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Arkansas, one in Cheyenne, Wyoming, one in Orange County News Channel, actually, down here in Southern California. They were associated with us. And each student was assigned an actual station that you would work for and cover their local interests on Capitol Hill and do stories, cut them up, write them, report them, stand-ups, the whole thing, send them back, and your stuff would be used on the air.
Wow.
So like real-life experience, yeah. Right? I decided to not just work for one affiliate. I decided to be the sports reporter for all of them. For Fort Smith, Arkansas, and Fayetteville, Arkansas. Arkansas was had the famous Nolan Richardson 40 Minutes of Hell college basketball team that won the national championship while I was there in the spring of 1994. Mm-hmm. And the president of the United States at the time was Bill Clinton.
Right.
So I covered Bill Clinton's response. You know, I try to just work what would be of interest to these stations and what I could do there. John Daly, who is an Arkansas Razorback, was coming through
golfer.
The TPC of Avenel. So I went and I interviewed him. Mm. The Orange County News Channel, the California Angels were coming through Camden Yards. I went to Baltimore. I did that. So I tried to put everything together to utilize the U.S. Olympic team that had just won a bunch of golds at the 94 Winter Olympics were visiting the White House. So I went to the White House and did a package on that day. And so I try to utilize my opportunities to match up with the local interest of the Medill News Service. Now, the Medill News Service was run by a professor named Lou Prato, P-R-A-T-O. And he was a real tough son of a gun. The piece that I told you about on the Arkansas Razorbacks, that got placed on the machines that would send it back to Fayetteville. It was an ABC affiliate. So that wound up on the ABC Evening News, some of my reporting, because it had to do with Clinton and the White House and all that. And then my Olympics piece, where I did my stand-up in front of the White House lawn, ran on Good Morning America.
Wow.
It made it. And like a friend of mine called me up, like, I just saw you on Good Morning America. And here I am. I'm like, I am making it. I am like, this is awesome. So I, to be honest with you, Eli, I coasted the next 2 days. Like I didn't do a damn thing. I was feeling it. I had been, I went national and then I went basically global on my first two pieces for the Medill School of Journalism at the Medill News Service. And Lou Prado called me and he cursed me out. Like, I cannot say on this podcast what he sent to me. And he's just like, who the hell do you think you are? Like, what's your next thing? Because of my 3 years of real world experience and my newspaper, I had been used to this. My editor at the Staten Island Advance never gave me a compliment in 3 years. So I kind of was used to not needing the attaboy from my boss, but Lou gave me a complete sense of what it would be like to be working for a news director in the real world. And for that, he has been one of the most invaluable educators I've ever come across. He was awesome. A lot of students didn't like him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of parents of those students would call up and complain about his gruff style. But that's the real world, man.
Yeah.
That is the real world. You're going to run into a bunch of a-holes in the real world. And he was a great A1. He had a sensibility and a heart about him. He was as invaluable for me as an educator in my experience.
Mm. I'm interested in this notion of writing and broadcasting and
yes.
the connection between the two.
Yes.
because I think about even someone, you know, someone like you, someone like Bill Simmons, who really started and made a name as a writer. A lot of his staff at The Ringer sort of started as writers on
Grantland before, yeah.
Yeah, which was so great. I think about, I love Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon.
Yep.
Wilbon's another Medill graduate.
And Tony, both of them are New York Post scribes from, they're ink-stained wretches, to use the old school phrase, yeah.
That's right. And so I'm curious whether sort of the, yeah, as you say, the ability to organize your thoughts.
Yes.
To be concise and economical with your words sinks into your mind when you're suddenly there with a microphone in front of you and suddenly you're translating things verbally in just as clear a way.
Right.
Yeah.
It's there's an art to it. There's no two ways about it. And, you know, and if there's any students that do listen to this pod, I will always advocate for the written word being paramount.
Yeah.
And I just know a lot of kids don't see it that way. Certainly not at this age of certainly middle school. I couldn't write a lick when I was in middle school. I couldn't figure out a damn thing, which led to some interesting moments between me and my dad when he was trying to tutor me at home. It was a struggle, but a light bulb went on, thank goodness. It, just like a phrase that I hear used, for a friend of mine talked about how it takes longer for boys than girls to sometimes get stuff.
True.
The coin dropped. The coin dropped for me. It's paramount. It's a serious craft. It's a differentiator. It's a separator for anybody to become successful, certainly in the communication world. It all stems from knowing how to write. All of it. The verbal communication, the ability to feel comfortable talking off the top of your head, the ability to read a teleprompter and put something on it that's compelling. It all starts with the written word. Every single time. And those educators that can communicate that successfully are also differentiators, for sure.
So I want to talk about SportsCenter. You end up joining ESPN, I'm sure, which was a dream of a lot of kids back then.
Mm-hmm.
If you could speak to, I guess, whether there were people there. I know Stuart Scott was a person who you did some broadcasts with over the years, but whether there were people there at ESPN that were mentors to you, that helped to encourage you to become a leader there. Eventually, you left for the NFL Network, which I want to get to.
Sure.
But what was that ESPN experience?
Oh, gosh. I was age 26 when I got the call. Like I said, the headhunter told me, send a good written word. They reached out. They called me. They called me at work. I'll never forget that day when I got the call from the guy who I'd been sending unsolicited tapes to for years, to no avail. Called me saying, we want to interview you. Hmm. We want to have you out for an audition. We want to interview you. We want to have you out for an audition. A guy named Al Jaffe, who was in charge of the talent there at the time. And I wound up getting an audition. The night before the audition, it was a Sunday night. The audition was Monday morning. I just couldn't sleep. I just couldn't. I was restless. So I turned on SportsCenter just to watch it, like every other Sunday for me. And it was Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann, the big show. And I just remember watching it and began to say, this is the way I would have done that highlight. That's the way I would have done that highlight. You know, watch the entire show under the manner of what I would have done with the same material. I don't know if I was just psyching myself up or just passing the time, getting ready. But the next day, it was time for the audition. And I was, as you might have, overwhelmed, nervous. There I am. I'm walking around ESPN. Looks nothing like the newsroom of Redding, California, KRCR-TV. They say to me, okay, here's the rundown for today's audition. We're going to use the same highlights that we used on SportsCenter last night.
Wow.
Yep.
So you were completely prepared.
Unbeknownst to me.
Wow.
No idea. Preparing myself for the next day and also showing up completely prepared, which as anybody else who's listening as well, if you're a student, preparation is the biggest weapon you have to succeed on a battlefield of getting a job or anything. And it immediately calmed me down. I'm like, I've got this. I know exactly what I'm going to do. I know exactly how I'm going to say it. I know exactly when I'm going to say it. Oh my gosh, I killed the audition. I crushed it. And I remember Al Jaffe coming out of the control room, big smile on his face. Because I'm sure he must have been some executives that were there going, really, this guy from, you know, who's been on the air a year and a half from market 200, whatever, like you're going to really, we're going to put him on SportsCenter. So I'm sure I validated his thoughts. I got hired. Wow. Age 26, showed up for work. February of 96, I left KRCR-TV. And my first sports center was a round of 32 March Madness Saturday. Probably a dozen highlights for me to do. And I had only seen one of them prior to the broadcast because everything was just finishing up. And some games were still going on. And I remember walking down to the to the set thinking I've got two choices. I could suck it up and just do my best, or pee down my leg. And I think I did both. And, you know, I just went for it. And just in terms of being having mentors there, just everybody was great. Honestly, there were no snakes in the grass or anything like that. I shared an agent with Keith Olbermann, who gave me a lot of tough love, but I expected Dan Patrick hazed me from the start. Which I took as tough love. I would do the overnight sports centers at the time, the 2 a.m. sports centers, and you kind of mentioned Stuart Scott. May he rest in peace. That's what I did most of my shows with at that hour. Mm. But at the beginning, just like my audition, if a highlight was fine and usable from the 11 o'clock show for the 2 a.m. show, they would just keep it. You would just use the same and not redouble someone's efforts of editing something.
Yeah.
Any of those same tapes, meaning same from 11 o'clock was going to be used in my show, as soon as they came up from downstairs in this big plastic bin, I would sit down at a machine in the newsroom and put on some headsets and watch them. So I'd get ready.
Yeah.
So I would do that diligently. And I just remember sitting at the machine one night, right around midnight, 12:15, and I'm just popping these tapes into my own world, and I just feel like this presence to my left, and I look up, and it's Dan Patrick standing over me. He goes, "So, you nervous?" In that, you know, sotto voce voice of his. He was great. He would give me advice every now and then, and I was just allowed to sink or swim, and thankfully I swam.
Yeah. So then, this is now going back 20 years now, you decide to leave for the NFL network. Now the idea of 24-hour NFL news seems quite normal, compelling. Back then, 20 years ago, making that jump, why did you believe that people would really pay attention to the NFL?
Okay.
360.
So
365.
Let me, I guess, to put it all together, when I started doing SportsCenter in 96, it was assumed the viewer had either not yet seen the game that we were about to deliver the highlight for, or you'd just seen it once and were up for having an entertaining way of having it delivered to you in a highlight form to refresh your experience.
Right.
That was the general gist of SportsCenter. Again, the written word where you'd be on camera, there was this lead-in, as we would say, where you would set up the highlight with a story to set up the backstory of the game or whatever. Sometimes Craig Kilborn would just have some wild William Shatner type reference that had nothing to do with the game. Just some, you would use that real estate in an entertaining way or a way to set up the highlight, give a backstory that the highlight would then play out, flesh out the backstory in your lead-in. And that's the way SportsCenter was, and I loved doing that. Then when the 21st century hit in the early aughts, there was an advent of cell phones and the internet. And so the show went from being produced and conceived under the notion that you were coming to see something either for the first time or the first time again, to assuming you knew, you know all about it. You know who won, you know how many points, you know how it affected your fantasy team, you know how it affected everything. You are now coming to find out why something happened. So my role changed. And at the time in the early aughts, the CNN had a huge show called Crossfire, where argument television started becoming a metric or a form of entertainment. And so SportsCenter anchors suddenly morphed more into a role of being a moderator of two analysts coming on to argue about why something happened. And I didn't like it. I also wanted to start doing other things. You know, Disney had bought ESPN, and I wanted to do stuff like Good Morning America. I mean, let's not forget one of my first stories, right, at Northwestern. I wanted to do more. I want to play more in the toy chest. I wanted to call games. I wanted to, and management there was not into that idea. Long story short, My contract was up in 2003. I was getting married to Susie. Susie and I were about to get married. And by the way, Susie and I met at ESPN in the newsroom.
Ah.
So our children are all ESPN kids. And that's another reason why I have nothing but affinity for ESPN, having, despite not worked for them in 21 years now. But I kind of held my ground. So 10 days before my wedding, I was handed a cardboard box, literally.
Wow.
My wedding did have some empty seats. Susie and I got married with some place cards for ESPN executives that went unclaimed at our wedding.
Wow.
Yeah. So NFL Network was being born at the time by Steve Bornstein, who was a longtime president of ESPN. Although he wasn't instrumental in hiring me there, I was his handpicked choice to launch NFL Network.
Yeah.
And move out to Los Angeles. My other choice was to potentially call Braves games for TBS as they were revamping their broadcast there. I wasn't terribly into the idea, although Susie, being a sports broadcaster, was doing some games for Turner and TNT. I just didn't want to start our marriage off with me spending 3 days in Houston, 4 in Wrigley Field, and 3 in Coors Field. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a great way to start off a relationship. I kind of preferred to launch something new and live in Los Angeles. And my bet that the NFL was of interest to a lot of people was, I think one would say, an educated risk.
It was the right one.
And everyone was telling me there's no greater feeling in your career than to start something new. It's going to be yours forever. And Susan and I wanted to live, I think we were having our hearts set on living on the East Coast, but she had been out here for 3 years covering the Shaq, Kobe, Lakers. By the way, I mean, when she was here working for Fox Sports Net, she covered the Shaq, Kobe, Lakers, the Pete Carroll Trojans, and the Tim Salmon, Darren Erstad, Troy Percival Angels.
Wow.
So she was... Trophies were everywhere when she was, you know, working for Fox Sports Net out here. But that also meant she was familiar with the area and not terribly averse to wanting to stay here. So it put it all together, and it was a no-brainer to come and live out here for NFL Network. And we've been here since 2003, and we love it here.
Yeah.
We love it here. We love our lifestyle here. We love the people that we've met here. And now, again, we're part of the Harvard-Westlake community. We're meeting more people. We're enjoying the experience. We love seeing Cooper's mind get expanded. I mean, obviously, it's been the right choice in so many different ways. So,
when you think of the people you work with at the NFL Network, who are some of the great people that come to mind?
The people that I've worked with, like Marshall Faulk and Deion Sanders and Steve Mariucci and Kurt Warner. Michael Irvin was at our wedding, as a matter of fact.
Oh,
Susie,
really?
Yeah, Susie knew him from Fox. So when he showed up at our wedding in an electric blue tuxedo, all my friends were like, is that Michael Irvin over there? And Michael, you know, spoke at Taylor, our daughter, our youngest, baby naming. He's as great a human as they come. So just getting to know these people and these Hall of Famers and these men of the year type individuals, it's been great.
Lastly, what's the thing you enjoy most about what you do? What do you love most?
Oh, I love just how different it is every day. I mean, seriously, you and I are recording today. My third hour guest on my show today was the actor Dennis Quaid. So we get to talk about his films and his movies. And the show that I've built here over the last 10 years is, you know, an amalgam of pop culture, which is movies, TV, but also sports. I mean, sports is there's a reason why our greatest or biggest event exported, the Super Bowl, gets stopped in the middle of it for a rock concert. Nobody bats an eyelash. You know what I mean? Talking pop culture, conventional pop culture around sports, to me is a no-brainer. And it's been seamless, although I shouldn't say that because I'm on sports talk radio. So I'm sure there's some program directors are like, why are we talking about Stripes right now? Why are we talking about, which we talked about with Dennis Quaid because apparently he was an extra in it years ago. But my first hour guest was the Stanley Cup. Stanley Cup was coming through here. The NHL reached out saying, you want us to bring the Stanley Cup in studio? And we had the keeper of the cup. There's five individuals who travel around the country with the Stanley Cup.
Wow.
So I'm hanging out with the Stanley Cup and Dennis Quaid in the same day. And then talking to people, you know, like that's the thing I love about my show every day is folks are calling in. That's always been the search in broadcast television, is breaking the fourth wall, as they say. How do you connect with the viewer? How do you actually connect with people who are taking in your content. Well, when you do sports talk radio or just radio in general, the wall gets broken by the telephone. They call in. Mm. So I speak to people, and I love the byplay back and forth. I did stand up in college at Michigan, and so there is that sort of back and forth that I get to enjoy a live tightrope walk every day, and that it's different. And then I get to share it with people, whether it's viewers or watchers, with the guys that I work with. Susie is a guest host of the program. She takes my best dad ever sign off and puts best mom ever on it. And I love that. I love that my wife is sitting in the chair as an extension of the show, and obviously our family. And then others that we have as guest hosts. And I mean, I could go on and on and on about the things that I love about it. I get to express opinions. I get to talk about topics from UConn winning it all, or Caitlin Clark almost winning it all, or a solar eclipse that people are crazy about. It's just whatever's on my mind, and I'm very fortunate enough to have that.
So to finish up, we have three final questions.
Okay.
They relate to Los Angeles, where you've now lived for the last couple of decades.
Yes.
We are known for our movies.
Yes.
Our food,
okay,
and our climate.
All right.
So the first question is, what is Rich Eisen's favorite movie?
Okay. My favorite dramatic movie is The Sting. I think it's a perfect movie. I love it. I just can't get enough of it. I've watched it more than any other movie. Normally you'd hear Godfather or Goodfellas or something like that, and they are great too. I love The Fugitive is another one. In terms of comedy, Midnight Run is my favorite comedy of all time. Can't show that to Coop yet, though. There are some scenes in it that I don't know are suitable for children.
Yeah.
The In-Laws is another great one, an old school one. All the Police Squad, Airplane, Naked Gun movies, all that stuff.
What's your favorite meal in L.A.? It could be at a restaurant that you love, or it could be something that you and Susie make at home.
Oh, we don't make anything at home. Are you kidding? We do like going to Ebaldi here in town.
Beverly Hills.
We like going there. Craig's. We've gotten to know Craig. Craig Susser was working behind the bar at Dantana's when Susie was living out here in L.A. working in for Fox Sportsnet. And I would come out here as a sports center anchor, as a long-distance relationship for a couple of years. Got to meet Craig behind the bar when he was making drinks at Dantana's. And now that he owns his own spot, it's great to see him crush it as a friend, and obviously go and whenever it's Coop's birthday or Xander, our oldest son's birthday, or Taylor's birthday, they want to go to Craig's to celebrate. Might be that big, huge-ass sundae that he serves with the candle that looks like a rocket ship. That might help.
What's your favorite place in L.A.? It could be an area of town or...
I don't know. We just like going to the beach in Malibu every now and then. It's a nice palate cleanser. You go out there and you just see the sun setting over the Pacific Ocean, man. That's why we live here. That's why we pay all these taxes, right? Yeah, it's funny. When I first started at NFL Network, when I moved here from ESPN, and I would spend like hours in studio and hours indoors preparing and hosting these shows. And I would go outside and I'm like, man, it's like 70 degrees out. I'm missing what's going on here. And then I realized the next day is most likely going to be like that too. And just relax, calm down. Now, all of a sudden, I'm showing up to Dodger games in the second inning and leaving in the seventh. And I used to make fun of these people.
You're becoming a Los Angelino.
I used to make fun of all these people as a diehard Yankee fan, watching the camera widen out as Kirk Gibson homers off of Eckersley and seeing all the taillights of the cars who were trying to beat the traffic. And the other night, Susan and I are going to the Springsteen concert at the Forum, and we had the set list in front of us. We knew that the last song would be something we've seen him do before. We're like, we'll miss that so we can get the hell out of here. And we're high-fiving as we're getting home. We're on the 405, and I'm like, what the hell happened to us? We're two East Coasters. She's from Boston. I'm from New York. We both love Springsteen. Back in the day, we would never have done that to beat the traffic.
This place changes you.
What the hell, man? So I guess my favorite place in Los Angeles is the front seat of my car, getting out of a parking lot before everybody else. I guess I finally drilled down to where my favorite spot is.
Very last question.
Sure.
You have three children.
I do.
I'm the parent of two. I have two daughters.
Yes.
Who are little. They are 5 and a half.
Yes.
And 2 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
The last question I ask every guest is, what is your best parenting advice for me?
Oh my gosh. What a Dwight Gooden 12 to 6 curveball you just snapped off on me at the end of this thing. Oh my God. I should say Clayton Kershaw. Pardon me. here in Los Angeles, is to soak in the moment the best that you can. Because even the moments where you are insanely frustrated by what's playing out in front of you, you're going to miss later on. I'm learning that right now. Patience is a virtue. My God, I'm just throwing out a magic eight ball of cliches at you right now. I mean, it truly is a virtue, and it's also there's no guide on how to do this thing. I'm amazed that my parents did such a good job, because I'm sometimes fumbling for the light switch quite a bit. And Susan and I are trying to, you know, we're trying to be a team together. So my kids get the same, you know, instructions from everybody. And it's not easy, but just soak it in best you can, because there are moments where you're going to miss them when they're gone, even though you're like, when they were babies, like, can you explain to me why you're crying right now? You know, when you're 5 and 3, you're like, can you just not do that? Can't wait till you're going to be able to take care of yourself on your own, where I don't have to make sure that you're going to potentially poke your eye out just walking from a chair to the table. You know what I mean? Then they have that ability, and then you just miss those other moments, and you're just wondering, did I not enjoy them in the moment as much as I could? And you beat yourself up like that. You're constantly beating yourself up like that. And it is, to use a March Madness phrase, a survive and advance mentality that you have in the age of what they're at right now.
Yeah.
But just soak it in as best you can, because you will miss it. And be as present as you possibly can for them, you know, as difficult as it may be. Because they notice. They notice when you're on the phone.
Yep.
They notice when you're paying attention. They respect when you're there, even though they may not be showing you the proper respect. I mean, I guess I just gave you 5.
Pretty good.
But in no particular order. I gave you 5.
Rich Eisen, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Eli Goldsmith.
For joining the supporting cast here in person on
my
campus.
My pleasure.
Looking forward to the draft. It's one of my favorite days of the year.
I could see. You were locked in. And I'm happy to do this again. We just scratched the surface here. So
great. Well, thank you. Thanks for joining the supporting cast.
You got it, man.